This is the Current Federal Tax Developments brought to you by Lascalzo Institute for the week of July 10th, 2017. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by your State Society of CPAs along with the Lascalzo Institute as we just take a look at what's happening this week in taxes. And this week we're going to branch out a little bit. So one of the key developments we're going to spend a lot of time on this week is a new bill passed by the state of Washington that takes this whole tattletale bill concept that Colorado came up with last year in the use tax arena and now expands it rather dramatically by dropping the trigger level and making the penalties much worse. We'll also discuss an IRS action on decision that reminds us that a tax court decision doesn't trump the Internal Revenue Code. At least that's the argument the IRS is going to be making here. And finally, we'll take a look at a case where a taxpayer lost any deduction for a charitable contribution of an interest in real estate because they failed to put the basis of the asset being donated to the charity on the tax form as required, one of the disclosure issues that we run into. Now, this is the week that, you know, we start doing all these wonderful things. We're past the 4th of July, so we're coming up on more CPE. Now, as I mentioned last week, I'm going to be in Montana coming up here in a couple of weeks. So you still have time to sign up for those courses in Bozeman. The course is dealing with the trusts and estates and the depreciation and fixed assets course in Bozeman. So if you have time, check the Montana site for that. After that, I'm coming up with a couple of courses that will be here in the American Southwest, doing a pair of those. First, I'll be in New Mexico in Albuquerque. On August the 3rd, I'll be doing a session with Accounting Methods as a Tax Planning Service, filing Form 3115 to save taxes. This is going to take a look at the idea of what is an accounting method, why you should be worried about accounting methods, and perhaps how you could help your client plan for those, as well as discuss the basic problems of what happens if you're not using a proper accounting method and the service comes back at you. On August the 4th, I'll be doing a course in Albuquerque on financial planning strategy for life wealth cycles. That's a general financial planning course that we'll be doing there on the 4th of August. If you want to sign up for either of those courses, which will be at the New Mexico Society offices in Albuquerque, you can check online at their website, nmscpa.org, and sign up for either of those courses or both at that site. I'll then be going on the next week to come back here to Phoenix. And we'll be doing three courses here in Phoenix at the Arizona Society offices. On August the 9th, I'll be talking about fringe benefits 2017. We'll try to figure out if we have any more information about what the new healthcare law may be by then. Again, that's kind of up in the air. We'll see if by then we'll know. By then, they'll be in the August recess. So either they'll actually have gotten something done in the few weeks they have coming back here in July, or we're going to really know that we're down to the wire on whatever's happening with healthcare. At least they want to get it done before the end of September. You know, the whole question about can you have a budget resolution that goes when you're beyond the end of the year you're setting the budget for? That's an interesting question. August the 10th, I'll be doing a course on preparing Form 1041. There we will discuss about some of the intricacies of taxations of trusts and estates for income tax purposes. Plus, we'll take a look at, because it's important to prepare the 1041 to understand accounting income, we'll have a discussion of the Arizona Uniform Principal and Income Act. So that'll be part of that course there on the 10th. On August the 11th, I'll do the full-day course on ethics and quality control and tax practice. That course qualifies in Arizona for 4 hours of ethics CPE plus 4 hours of tax CPE. That course is essentially an expanded version of ethics that then goes beyond and starts looking at tax practice, quality control, and what issues and what problems we have in the area of tax practice that we should be dealing with. Those courses will be offered by the Arizona Society. They'll be offered in Phoenix, and they will be webcast. If you want to sign up for those courses, go to the Arizona Society website at ascpa.com. And as with New Mexico, you want to just follow the links to the CPE courses. You'll be able to find and check in for those courses. Well, let's get to the developments this week. And the big one comes from the state of Washington. And Washington, the governor has signed, according to tax analysts, has signed into law Washington House Bill 2163. That particular bill is a bill dealing with out-of-state sellers who sell into the state of Washington. And the question there becomes, what do those sellers have to do about informing their customers and informing the state of Washington about the potential missing use tax these people are not paying? You may remember we discussed last year, the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that it is okay for states to require out-of-state vendors to turn in their customers by reporting, you know, who's bought from your mail order or your website, who lives in this state. And technically, the 10th Circuit found that that did not violate the nexus requirements in Quill, because they said you don't need nexus for this because the state's not asking you to collect taxes. So Quill does not apply in this case. Rather, you're merely being asked to report. Now, we say that, but in reality, the reporting is going to be such a pain that the rational thing to do, if you're faced with this law, it's going to occur to a lot of people, is going to be to just collect the sales tax for the state in question and get out of this whole reporting mess, which will be a nightmare of having to report. Plus, your customers will definitely get letters from you that say, effectively, we're turning you into the state. So that's probably not good. You're probably better off collecting the sales tax than telling your customers that we're turning you into the state and you need to file forms if you buy from us. So honestly, yeah, it's really pushing that way. Now, this is important because in December of last year, the Supreme Court declined a request to hear the appeal of this case by the Direct Marketing Association. The case in question was Direct Marketing Association versus Broll was the case. And essentially, the Supreme Court denied certiorari on the case. Not surprisingly, a lot of people thought that following that, we're going to see states begin to enact such laws. The state of Washington now has enacted just such a law. And what we're going to find here is, because the Supreme Court did not take that appeal, the state of Washington's law was adopted. And the big difference, though, is this law has really strict penalties, and the trigger level for having to report to the state of Washington is much lower than other states that either have this type of law, like Colorado, or have had the concept of economic nexus. That is where the theory is, well, if you just sell like $500,000 into the state, you effectively have a presence in the state. And that's been pushed by some states to force collection of sales tax. This is kind of a backdoor way, because those laws, you still worry about whether Quill is a problem. But in this case, we're now with, well, we don't worry about Quill, and the 10th Circuit's agreed. Quill doesn't apply because this is not a sales tax collection requirement. So what we end up with here is this particular law will apply to anybody selling to residents of the state of Washington if in any calendar year those sales go over $10,000. Now, it's interesting that we measure this based on total sales for the year, but apparently per the law, if I get my $10,000 worth of sales on December 31st, I suppose we should have been complying with this law for the whole year, which presents a problem because it's a little difficult to retroactively comply with the law. Now, this law has some very detailed requirements for notice and other issues. So let's talk about where those things go. If you are covered by this law, you first have to give notice that is a pre-sale notice to your customers. You have to post a conspicuous notice on your marketplace, platform, website, catalog, or any similar medium. However you're selling, where people from Washington will discover you're selling this stuff, you have to inform Washington purchasers that sales or use taxes due on purchases from you, certain purchases. Washington requires you to file a use tax return if we don't collect the sales tax from you. And the notice is being provided under the provisions of Washington state law that you're required to do so. As well, if the customer actually buys the product, so now the customer's been to your website, he sees your product, he decides, I want that product. Now we have to provide another notice. At this point, this notice at the time of the sale has to say that neither sales nor use tax is being collected or remitted upon the sale, and tell them as well that they must remit sales or use tax directly to the state of Washington, and give them instructions for obtaining information about how to file that form with the state of Washington. This would go on your invoice, the emailed invoice, whatever you use for them to inform them at the time of sale. You know, those documents transmitted at the time of sale are going to have to include this notice. In addition, following that notice, you also have notices, as we said, at the time of sale. That's what I just mentioned here. We have at the end of the year, though, now we get to December. At the end of the year, we have to also send a basically a report to each customer that tells each customer how much they bought from us, right? We have to list by date, indicating what they bought or what they leased, if leasing is involved, in the preceding calendar year. Again, tell them how to find information about the forms to file with the state of Washington, and tell them they're required to do that report. And finally, give them any other information that the Washington Department of Revenue decides under regulations they'll issue in the future should be provided with that sale. Finally, having basically hammered home to the customer three times, you need to tell the state of Washington, we're now going to backstop this by requiring the seller to also tell the state of Washington about the sales to Washington customers. We're going to give the state of Washington a summary report every year. Has to be filed. By the way, the notice, year-end notice to customers and the summary report need to be provided by February the 28th. We need to provide the customer's name to the state of Washington, their billing address, and if known, the last mailing address, what address we shipped products to for delivering the state of Washington, and the total amount of such purchases by the consumer. So we're going to essentially tell Washington, you should be seeing a use tax report from this person located at this address for this amount of purchases from us during the year. Obviously, PR-wise, this is not going to be great for your customers. They're going to wonder, you know, why in the world are you turning on me? Now, the problem is the penalties here are rather nasty, because you might say, well, that's great, but I'm located in Vermont. How in the world is the state of Washington going to actually enforce this against me? Who cares? Well, the first problem we've got on the penalty side of the equation is, if the Tenth Circuit is correct, and if the other circuits go along with this, and you hate to say it, but the Supreme Court has been turning down appeals in a whole bunch of cases where the states have been expanding their reach. That probably sends a notice to the courts of appeal that realistically, you know, as far as Supreme Court's concerned, this is no problem. So if the, you know, if your circuit court agrees that this is enforceable, by the way, if they don't, that'll be when we'll actually maybe get the Supreme Court to hear the appeal. But if they decide it's enforceable, then the penalties that Washington imposes inside the state of Washington will be enforceable against you in Vermont. And under the full faith and credit clause of the Constitution, the courts of Vermont would be technically required to enforce the judgments from Washington under the basis that unless they have a constitutional objection, which, you know, they won't, under this theory, the courts have said it's okay, Supreme Court seems to be just fine with this, these penalties will apply. And these penalties are nasty. So first off, if you don't give the on-screen notice or catalog notice, remember that pre-sale notice or the notice basically that you're also supposed to give on your invoices, if you miss either one of those, the minimum penalty on top of all other penalties you may owe is $20,000. So there's now think about that, $10,000 worth of sales into the state and we're being penalized 20 grand. Yeah, you might figure the math there doesn't work so well, but we're not done with penalties yet. So on top of that, now that was for violating that rule of giving notice to the customers. There's another penalty. What if you fail to send that year-end summary to your customers by February the 28th? Well, that's based on a sliding scale. If you have receipts sourced to Washington of less than 50,000, the penalty is $5,000. It goes to 10,000 for receipts from 50 to 150,000. It goes to 50,000 for receipts from 150 or more, but less than 300. And then it, for those with receipts above 300, you take essentially a $100,000 penalty plus 25,000 for every $50,000 of gross receipts in excess of 300,000. So that penalty can grow to pretty big numbers. You know, we can be looking at some significant penalties. But at a minimum, we're looking at 5,000. It's important to just look at the minimums here, because for a lot of us, our clients may sell into Washington. And they may not sell a whole lot into Washington, but again, depending upon the size of your customer or the size of your client, 10,000 is not that much in retail sales. So similar penalties will apply. By the way, the same rules apply to what they're called referrers. That's like eBay, except eBay will not have to give notice. eBay will have to give notice to the customers when they come in, but then eBay or those sorts of organizations will also have to tell the sellers about this rule. and notify the sellers at the end of the year, notify, hey, seller, we referred you customers from Washington. Please remember, you've got to file this report with Washington. So those organizations do that too. So now you're talking about your small clients who may have sold, you know, four or five things on eBay are going to suddenly get this letter too. Just be aware those things end up happening. Now the catch there, they may not be required to file with Washington, but they're going to get this note that isn't so clear as to whether they have to do something with Washington. So just be ready for those. Finally, if you don't tell Washington, so let's say, remember that report, we're supposed to turn our customers to the state of Washington. That also triggers another $20,000 minimum penalty if I fail to report this to the state. So my total penalties are $45,000 at a minimum if I just simply decide I'm going to ignore this law. The law does give you some options to get out of the penalty, but it's a one-time only. The Washington Department of Revenue is only allowed to issue one of these waivers. And what they'll do, you automatically can get a waiver, a conditional waiver, if you enter into a written agreement with the Washington Department of Revenue to collect sales tax, or you decide to fully comply with the notice reporting requirements of the chapter in the future. Now, if you fail to do that, all the penalties and interest come right back at you. There is a four-year statute. Washington cannot enforce this back further than 4 years. It will take effect beginning January 1st, 2018. So we don't have any problem with old sales, except for Washington arguing you have nexus. But now with new sales, this is going to apply to everybody. Okay. Now, the fun thing about this is if you agree to just collect the sales tax, none of these rules apply to you. Let's be totally honest. That is what Washington is hoping you will do. It's what the legislature's looking for people to do. You need to be aware, this is probably not the last such tattletale law we are going to see enacted here in the next couple of years. That'll be especially true if, as is likely in this case, we have a challenge now in the Ninth Circuit. If the Ninth Circuit goes along with the Tenth, we now start getting circuits lining up on this thing. Don't be surprised if a whole bunch of states enact tattletale laws. We have a mini tattletale law that exists in Oklahoma. The only difference in Oklahoma is you don't have to tell the state, but you do have to give all these notices. Don't be surprised if we see, though, a whole bunch more tattletale laws come into play. Next up this week. Now, the IRS kind of forgot to argue something in a court case is what really appears to have happened here. We have IRS Action on Decision 2017-05 that was issued on June 30, 2017. In the case of Teixeira versus Commissioner, which was Tax Court Memorandum Decision 2016-200, a taxpayer at the end of the day was allowed to claim an earned income credit even though he filed married filing separate. He was married at the time, did not file a joint return with his spouse. Now, the IRS was attempting to claim that he really didn't have the kids, that he had other issues. They did all kinds of things to try to go after his child credits and all those other issues. But apparently, they were betting on their arguments in those areas to carry the day and never bothered to point out that on the earned income credit, Internal Revenue Code Section 32D specifically bars a married person from claiming the credit unless they file a joint return. So the tax court issued a decision in this case where they granted this gentleman an earned income credit on that return. Now, of course, the IRS is getting concerned because that case has been reported. And of course, people now start saying, the tax court has said you can file married separate and get an earned income tax credit. The IRS clarifies that, in fact, they just will tell you that the court got this wrong. I suspect the court got this wrong because the service never raised the issue at trial. So this AOD clarifies the IRS is not going to go along with this. What this means is if you go to appeals with somebody or you try to file the claim based on this, the service's position is they put you on notice that this is simply not good law. And they're saying, take a look at 32D. It specifically bars this. So if you try to file this, we're going to deny the claim. And don't be surprised if we don't try to get some penalties out of this one too. So just be aware. It's just an interesting case, though, that the IRS managed to get bad case law on the, or what they see as bad case law on the books, because apparently nobody mentioned this little problem at trial. Finally, let's take a look at the Rary Holdings 1 LLC versus Commissioner case, 149 TC number 1, 7317. Now, this particular part or set of partnerships related to this have been in the courts multiple times. We've talked about them before in an earlier case. They had a couple of other cases go by. They've had some problems making contributions here. In this particular case, though, this taxpayer acquired an interest in real estate, for $2.9 million. Just over 1 year later, they donated that same interest in real estate, to a charity. And they had an appraisal that said it was worth $33,019,000. Now, you might be a little concerned about how had it gone up that much, obviously. Well, generally, under the reporting rules for non-cash contributions, in addition to putting forward your appraisal, one of the required piece of information you have to include is how much did you pay for the property? What was your basis in the property? That's required to be reported under the regulations. You must report that information to the IRS. In fact, there's a whole series of things that you have to report when you make a non-cash contribution. But under regulation 1.170A-13C2IB, always love those deep citation in the regs. One of those requirements is that if you have a non-cash contribution in excess of $5,000, in addition, you know, fully completed information summary. And one of the things required to be there under E is the cost or the basis of the property. Well, they didn't tell the IRS the cost or the basis of the property. The taxpayer tried to argue, wait, no. Okay, yeah, we left one little detail out. But you know what? Under Bond versus Commissioner, which was 1000 TC32 citation is your case from 1993. If we substantially complied with the reporting requirements, so basically this is just a technical foot fault, it's nothing that serious, then we should be allowed the charitable contribution deduction. They allowed it in Bond. The IRS countered and said, wait, you know, but we think that the times it's not just, you know, just getting most of the stuff right's not good enough. They pointed to the case of Hewitt versus Commissioner, 109 TC258 from 97. That case, you may required, which involved one of the founders of Jackson Hewitt, he failed to get an appraisal of stock that was not at the time publicly traded. The stock in question was Jackson Hewitt stock. That was a technical violation. The court fully agreed that the stock was worth what he claimed, but the fact that he didn't get an appraisal and didn't attach it, the court considered that more than a foot fault. They considered that a major substantive failure, and they denied. So the question becomes, what in essence qualifies as being substantially, you know, having it substantially correct, you know, and being substantial compliance? Well, the tax court in this case said, you know, taxpayer, we kind of understand what you're doing here, but you know what? Well, we're going to judge this based on whether you provided sufficient information to permit the IRS to evaluate the reported contributions, because Congress was concerned with people claiming excessive contributions and then trying to kind of hide this from the IRS, not give the IRS enough information to really do an evaluation of this without having to examine every single tax return in front of them. And the court decided, you know, it is a significant fact that we have a piece of property here you paid less than $3 million for. And just over a year later, you're telling us it's worth over $33 million. They said, just on its face, that raises a reasonable question about whether or not that valuation might be severely overstated. And that would enable the service to quickly identify that this is a return we probably should take a look at to try to get an explanation. Kind of tell me, why is it worth $33 million today when it's only worth $3 million back then? Now, maybe we struck oil. Maybe there's gold under the hand. I don't know why it's worth that much. But you got to, you know, it's reasonable for the service to say we need an explanation about why it appreciated so much. Well, we're going to believe that, in fact, your appraisal is overstated. So, you know, we want to go take more look at that detail as to why it's worth that much. The court said because of that, this was not just a, you know, no big deal. This was actually a major omission. So you did not have substantial compliance because, in fact, you did not substantially comply with the requirements that that exist in the code. Now, this reminds us, look, we've had a series of cases that go all the way from somebody not getting a receipt for, you know, for a small donation, not getting receipts when they did non-cash contributions to Goodwill, you know, all the way up to, you know, these areas this size. The one constant is the tax court is making very clear under Section 170 of the code, Congress got upset and Congress requires strict documentation. While you do have the bond case to try to fall back on, that is a very limited usefulness. And in fact, in most cases, the tax court since bond, and I would remind you that bond was decided back in 1993. The fact that 4 years later, under Hewitt, they had decided that a contribution they otherwise agreed was totally okay, you know, and was totally acceptable, and the value was fine, we're still going to deny it because you didn't attach the appraisal. The tax court has gone to now a very strict construction of charitable contribution documentation requirements. Your clients need to understand that there's really not a lot of, you know, unless you can just persuade the agent to ignore the problem or persuade appeals to ignore the problem. And I think it gets tougher the higher you get on this ignore the problem issue. You really are dead in the water. You're not going to be able to reasonably threaten tax court as a way to get the IRS to back down. The tax court's made it very clear. Those documentation requirements are meant to be followed strictly. Your clients need to understand those documentation requirements. And by the way, your staff needs to understand those documentation requirements because all of these things are important. Remember, when we take information from our clients don't understand these rules. We have to communicate to our clients the things they have to have in order to justify their charitable contribution. And that means if you have a contribution in excess of $250, let's not even worry about something this size. Remember, they need to have that receipt before the return's filed. Strict rules on charitable contribution documentation are going to be required to be followed. So if you're putting anything on Schedule A for charitable contributions, your clients have to understand the documentation they're going to need in order to have that sustained on an exam. And if they don't have it, if they don't have it, they tell you it's not there, you're taking an audit lottery position. And by the way, as we know, audit lottery positions violate the professional standards under the AICPA rules. They violate the standards under 6694 of the code for penalties to preparers. So essentially, you can't really put it on the return if the client says, I don't have the documentation, let's just go with it. Well, you know, it's summer. We've been doing taxes all this time. You've probably been doing your extensions and you may be looking a little harried. Those of you who are watching the video of this, you may see our harried accountant on the screen. If you're beginning to look like our harried accountant on the screen, you know, and you're beginning to look a little rough, you know, and it's been a while since you shaved, we'll phrase it for this individual on the screen, you might want to go ahead and take a little bit of a break and get your education up to speed and take a look at your live state society catalogs where you can, A, get away from the office, which is always useful, I find, because if I'm in the office, clients seem to think I'm always available. That's one of the negatives of taking your continuing education via online courses. They're fine. I take them too, but reality is that people always think they can step in and just interrupt you when that's going on. Here, you actually get away from the office and concentrate. And we've got a series of live cases where it's also just a lot easier to ask questions and get your questions answered those live courses. Be sure to check your catalogs for the live courses that are available. As I said, I'm going to be doing a few coming up here in Montana, in New Mexico, in Arizona here over the next few weeks. So be sure to check that. We have a bunch of others going around the country, both in taxes and ANA from the Lascalzo Institute. So be sure to check your state society catalogs and sign up for the courses that are being offered by your state. This has been the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of July 10th, 2017. You can catch our daily updates, or maybe not daily, but however often we write when something significant happens, on our website at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also download a PDF that has articles that talk about what we've talked about in more detail today with links to the source documents as well. If you have any questions or comments, you can send them to me, Ed Zollers at currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can also follow me on Twitter. My handle there is at Ed Zollars. And, you know, I'll post there. Whenever something goes on the site, I generally post on that site. So you want to follow me there, you can. Well, we'll see how this week comes. Congress is coming back in this week, so we'll certainly be able to see. Maybe we have a healthcare bill answer, or maybe not. And we'll also see what comes up with the courts and other rulings over the next week. So be sure to join us next week for the current federal tax developments.